Very, very interesting questions and the perspectives that you bring to the table. Let me try to just engage in a conversation. I won't necessarily have answers, certainly not good answers to some of these issues that you have raised. Where do we start? There is no clear stopping point, as you rightly anticipated. I guess what I'm saying is we stop too early right now. And we could go a little further, and it's going to change things. We are doing 10% now, say shareholder, accounting for the shareholder, and just ignoring what firm is doing to others. It's nowhere in the reporting system. And if I may wind forward to your comment, it has tremendous impact on the debate and discussion and policy and theories, because data is not there. And again, winding forward, since you asked me for the example, the strongest example comes to my mind is when in US, the Financial Accounting Standards Board issued a standard a few years ago about pension accounting. Corporations used to account for pension in all kinds of different ways. And cities and firms, state government units and all that. And Accounting Standards Board said, if you have made a promise to provide health benefit or pension benefits, you better record the present value for those promises made as an expense, and if you haven't paid them out in cash, you record it as a liability. Okay? Perfectly reasonable thing to do from an accountant standpoint. What does the corporation do? Within the last 15 years, US corporations have switched from what was called defined benefit plans, where employees were promised certain dollar amount of benefits, sometimes index benefits for inflation, to defined contribution plans. Okay. Yes. So I think I can give you any number of examples. Yes, the way you do the accounting affects the real world. It changes how people do things. You look at stock options. Start doing accounting. What FASB had suggested in 92 about recording the option value as an expense when you granted a stock option to the executives was a perfectly economically reasonable thing to do. And in Silicon Valley, it will sound like hell broke loose, that the American system will come down, it'll be the end of capitalism, and whatever. I think they were exaggerated, but yes. So answer to your question, going back to the issue. So I would say, I think where we are, we stop too early. We can reasonably go a little further without getting into quicksand, but we go far enough, we will get into quicksand, and numbers will become arbitrary. And we probably want to stop somewhere before that. All I'm suggesting is, I think we are stopping too early. That's all. Antoine, the issue you raise, again, a very important one. That's why I started the National Income Accounts, which is certainly a social science idea. Okay. Because the worker is already doing it, When I choose job one over job two, I'm already doing that accounting of how much fun it is to work for this, how much prestige it might bring to me, how much training is going to give me, what my neighbors or relatives might think about what kind of job I have. You know, all those intangibles which will be difficult to do for a third party are already being done by the individual, and certainly corporate accountant will have no ability to do that. So I'm thinking more like national income accounts, and national income accounts doesn't do this part right now, as far as I know. Maybe in France or some other countries, perhaps somebody will correct me on that, that such data is actually collected. So it will be estimation. It will use the statistical techniques, I think. And it won't certainly be at individual level. And I'm not even sure any centralized collection of data will be of any use to the individuals in their decisions anyway, you know? And customers and investors, customers and employees and so on, they do that. They make those assessments already. That aggregate data probably will not do them any good. But I think that aggregate data will make a difference to our debates and our discussions and our theory building. So that's what I have in mind. Let's see. And your point you made about, they are, to my mind, they're all risk bearers. I mean, the moment you, in fact, in the agency theory, as you know, the main driver of solving the agency models is the risk aversion for the manager. That is, this manager having limited amount of wealth, putting, you know, risk sharing models are essentially based on the manager being a risk averse individual. I'm not sure how useful it is, but the standard assumption that somehow shareholder bears all the risk and everybody is risk-free just makes no factual sense to me. Okay. Maybe somebody can argue it does, in which case we'll engage in that conversation. So I agree with you on that. David, your question about your definition of what accounting was supposed to be, managers doing the accountability, you know, fulfilling the accountability or stewardship duties. In this sense, if you try to estimate the extensive income or value of the firm, that will become managers' accountability to the larger society or community and not solely to the manager, not solely to the shareholder or owner, because again, shareholder orientation basically comes, as has been said many times by Yuri and others, comes that the shareholders or owners contribute the resources, everybody else, whatever they contribute, they get it right back and no extra. So all accountability you need to do, the risk sharing, risk bearing is being done by the owner. That's the perspective. Yes, I think owner does have a special position. I don't deny that point. I think with Pharma, owner has a special position in the sense that, see, the supplier of capital puts his or her money up front and has the largest amount of time, passage of time, before he gets a return, you know, after everybody else has been paid. What remains, supposedly, is, unless he steals it, according to the rules, he gets it last. Okay? And he gets what is left. So he does have a special interest in making sure that everybody else does what they're supposed to contribute and gets no more than what they're supposed to get under the contracts of the organization. They have a greater interest because they are at the bottom of the pile in terms of at the receiving end. So to that extent, there's some special rights I'm willing to grant to the shareholders, but only some. But in general, yes, everybody. So it's just a larger sense of accountability to the group as a whole. And what I'm saying is that we can integrate it into the standard accounting model as opposed to trying to do this triple bottom line, which gets us back to the commensurability problem in space. Okay? So I couldn't figure out how is the triple bottom line supposed to work. So one more of this and two less of this, what does it mean? Okay. So yes, we will get into that quicksand if we go far enough, but let's try to move incrementally take a few more baby steps and see if we can improve something on the margin. I am not, talking about this. And incommensurability is a very important thing to do, at least at aggregate level, in the sense that we have developed the system of national income accounts. They're not perfect. There are huge heroic assumptions made in national income accounts. Is it better than not having them? That's all I'm saying, okay? I think this may be better than not having them. Okay? If it is, then that will be determined if you try it out. That's all. Let's see. I think we talked about the different levels and rules of capitalism and how the behavior will change. We talked about pensions and others. And Rich's questions for you. Okay. I wasn't around when Mesopotamia, so I'll leave that to you.
Probably symmetry. Okay. I will try to come to the first question as the ultimate answer, so I will respond to Pierre after. So the main problem is how to upgrade the ownership logic with the accountability logic. So this is my idea, is to replace ownership with the enterprise entity. So to take a quite amazing project. So the answer with PAMA is, okay, if no ownership is addressed in the firm, no risk bearer exists, because more bearing the risk than another stakeholders. So you need some connection with the capital idea. It's the ancient idea of the over is the provider of capital and the financier and the manager of the entity. So it's just joking with the words and with this double system, because it's already in the Pareto logic, is the very founder of the general equilibrium economics. You have this double idea of capital as material and financial, and Pareto refused to apply the ownership logic because of the perfect competition, allowing Pareto himself to give to the surplus, to the shareholders, to the capital provider, beyond any idea of ownership of capital. It was the Pareto replies to Marx, because the problem at that time was the Marx critique of the Ricardo system. So the Ricardo system is based on the ownership entrepreneur, and to refuse the Marxist critique, they introduce the perfect competition, the system of markets, solving back the point. So the second point is about Schumpeter. There's someone that say we have left the Keynesian century and we are entering the Schumpeterian one. So I will try to argue with Schumpeter. Ownership is no longer the matter, because we have a financial system, and in the financial system, the shareholders are working as financiers, so as investors. It's a quite different logic. It's not the control of physical capital, it's not the control of the productive structure in the Ricardian way. But in this way, their position is special, but it's related to the financial system much more than to the idea of ownership. They don't need, no longer need the very control by property and ownership of the, but they are using the property rights, of course. And this is one of the problems we have to address when we try to upgrade the accountability logic to reply to David. When we start, the idea of surplus is the idea of the residual, is connected to the old idea of the ownership and the ownership entrepreneur. And if we move toward the accountability logic, the idea of surplus is no more required. So the accounting system is defining a wall of revenues and costs, and we step up to the income idea. It's not exactly the idea of value, but it's a system of flow, and we have no longer need of a surplus. So the surplus exists as such, but you could just allow all the distribution in an ex ante or ex post system and not provide the surplus at all. It's not the focus, no more the focus of the accounting system. This is the basic idea of accountability, quite connected with neoclassical revolution. I not disregard the neoclassical contribution on the matter. And this is connected to the question of the frontiers of the entity too. Professor Strasser addressed this question because the point of the frontiers is once again related to the point of ownership, because in the entity system we need to have legal frontiers to define the patrimony, so the net worth, and on the net worth calculated the difference between former and new net worth and calculated surplus. And when we switch to a system, a dynamic system, so a system of flow, monetary economic flows, inflows and outflows, the frontiers become vague, but it's not really a problem because we have a regulatory definition of the entity. So we have to define some operational ways by legal, organizational or epistemic conditions, but we don't need the idea of frontiers anymore. So I accept, but it's a comprehensive approach. So finally, ultimately, we don't have but one entity, our planet. So if we take it, it's the world economy, it's the entity, the accounting entity, or the entity we are accounting for. But for operational and organizational needs and institutional constraints too, we need some intermediate entities. Yeah, we have to do it with a regulatory system, just like all the time. And your remarks about units of account is really important, because when we leave the world of markets and ownership, we leave also the world of the money as a measure of value. So we cannot no longer consider prices as measure of value in this accountability world, because we face complexity, we face multi-layered reality. So we have qualities, not only quantities. And the point is really important not to be captured by the entity logic. So it's a really, really important matter about the measure of value, of the different ways of capturing it in an accounting system. But to me, accounting system is not only about measure. It's a process, it's a socio-economic process, well, concerning auditing, so several different actors and procedures and so on. And the second point is not necessarily concerned with monetary measures or even with measure at all. It could be a system of representation. It's not necessarily a quantitative measure in a physical sense. And let me reply with a backward reply to the problem of variety of capitalism and firms. Anyway, we have two facts, historically, history says, Once we developed the German and Japanese systems, so we have major change in economic theory and practices. And now, once again, when we are confronted with the rise of financialization, financial capitalism, we are confronted with the change of accounting system. So actors are saying to us, implicitly at least, accounting matter for them because they spent billions of dollars and time and resources to defy the received accounting systems and to deal with them, even in some unpredictable or doubtful way, but they do. So in a sense, it is testify for the impact of the accounting rule because actors are concerned with and are involved in their political process or producing different accounting rules. And this led to some theoretical insights because if we try to have some ideas, the previous systems developed by Japanese and German theorists and regulators was based on the continuity of the entity. It's a quite productive system based on continuity and allocation of incomes. And the new one is much more focused on the value of the firm and on the value of the firm and on the marketable condition. It's a sort of liquidity idea and liquidation idea of assets and liabilities in separately. So it's really a different understanding of the firms, in my view, and it's much more financial than productive. So this is some inference from the system. So I think we have several connections could be done. My work on the matter is much more theoretical. I try to point out just some key area of interest and interaction between the accounting system and why firms matter in the economic process. So we can start from to recognize other impacts. And, the CEO remuneration, for example, is one of the impacts in my sense because it's a part of the allocation of resources. It's not necessarily put out by the market, but it's a part of the income allocation inside the firm. So this implies the problem of disclosure or transparency when the entity issue is addressed. So the entity, we need disclosure, the reason is because the entity exists and we need something to look inside the entity. Because if markets are perfect or our are dominating the firm, no disclosure or transparency is required because the hours are deciding their own resources, uses and allocations. But the way this is done is quite complex. It's not a problem. It's not a market process, in my view. It's quite evident. It's a political process by nature, and political means here socio-economic and institutional at the same time, so the governance at the private and the regulation at the public level. But I'm not sure the whole transparency issues is the appropriate answer in every case. So it's quite sensitive. It's really, you could have good governance without disclosure, and you could have disclosure without impact on governance. So it's not so simple to address in terms of transparency and disclosure. I think it's better to speak about accounting regulation or accounting norm standards or accounting systems, because it's much more profound and I don't think it's not just about disclosure. Is how you construct the accounting system and the impact or potential impact of it on the firm and its dynamic and the behavior of actors and institutional objective too. So firms and corporation is the historical point. And I I used to be educated in neoclassical economics, quantitative economics modeling. So I have this basic bias in my education to think abstractly in a sort of mathematical way. So it's a model. It's a model of the firm, but it's historical by formation at least. So I don't know about Mesopotamia. I'm fascinated by the comparative historical analysis developed by Carpolani, you know, really transhistorical. And he tried to have some conceptual modeling, at least utilizing notion that by nature are constructed to be transhistorical. So he tried to focus some kind of transaction, anthropological transaction you could apply to analyze our society or the Mesopotamian society too. I'm not sure presently if the enterprise entity exists in every time. So when we started the book with Olivier, the authors, we decided to concentrate more modestly just on the capitalistic firm and the recent models. But we are not speaking just about corporation, because corporation is just one of the legal forms, and it's not enough to understand the inner economic substance we try to address. But I don't pretend to have an historical explanation of that.
Can I say one
more?
Sure. I just want to say one more thing about disclosure and transparency.
No,
and I'll just reinforce. At least in the U.S. discourse in accounting and corporate governance, transparency in recent years seems to have become the new holy grail. You know, it's something you cannot have enough of, and more is always better. But when you look at the problem of disclosure and transparency generally that have been carried out, you oftentimes reach the conclusion that transparency is good only to a certain degree, and beyond that it becomes dysfunctional and leads to less desirable outcomes in a contract theoretic sense. Just to clarify what I mean is, so my dean walks into my office and says, Shyam, we are going to put you in a glass-walled office. You know, we are all for transparency now. And you've been writing about transparency, so why not? I said, what, you know, say. He said, what do you do in your office that you don't want others to see? Nothing. So what's the problem? What's your objection to being put in a glass-walled office? Well, what do I say to my dean? Well, the truth is, I do take a 10-minute nap in the afternoon after lunch, as I did today when I was talking. And you know, that freshens me up, and I'm good for another 4 hours of work. It's good for me, and it's good for the school. Okay? So it's in your interest to let me take that nap. You put me in a glass-walled office, I'm not going to take that nap. Why not? Sure. Now I understand. We all understand. We'll send everybody a memo that Shyam takes a 10-minute nap. Don't disturb him, and don't hold it against him. Will I take a nap? No. Why not? In fact, I will spend some of my time and resources posturing, appearing, managing my appearances, right? Unproductively, which may actually be unproductive resources. So I think transparency, and this has been done very formally in formal models, doesn't mean they are any better than these off-the-cuff examples, but I think we have to be very careful in arguing, not that anybody has here, but I see that trend at least in what governance circles, you know, transparency and disclosure is a holy grail. Not so. There are very good reasons why we don't want to overdose on transparency, because we may end up being worse than where we started.
Some further comments?
Yes.
Yes.
May I ask one one question? I've read somewhere the subprime crisis has to do with fair value. Can you explain that? Because I'm not able to understand the link.
You meant we can be here until 5 p.m. tomorrow,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. very interesting issue, of course, very, very important. Fair value is has several problems, and subprime just to point out the difficulty with fair value. And I'll mention a couple of issues here. One, the language. It's a rhetorical choice of taking a method of valuation and calling it fair. Okay? You know, historical valuation is a method of valuation. Mark to market is a method of valuation. Fairness is a judgment, you know. You know, I mean, steak is a food, chicken is a food, but tasty is not a food, even if you call a particular dish tasty, you know. Now, this is a rhetorical device. In 1964, when U.S. President Lyndon Johnson needed money for fighting the Vietnam War and programs in the U.S., he wanted to use the Social Security surpluses for this purpose. What does he do? He sends a bill to U.S. Congress. What was that bill called? Unified Budget Act of 1964, challenging the Republicans to stand up and argue against unified budget. Would you like to argue against unified budget? Okay. 2002. 9/11 happens. President Bush wants to put constraints on civil liberties to fight the war on terror. He sends a bill to Congress. What does he call it? Patriot Act of 2002, forcing Democrats to stand up and argue against patriotism. 2006, FASB issues fair value accounting. Shyam Sundar, you don't like it? You like unfair accounting? Okay. Okay, so labeling is one problem, but I think there's, so let's set aside labeling. It's basically mark-to-market accounting. But mark-to-market accounting has an inherent pro-cyclicity built into it, in the sense that markets, to the extent they are not perfect, they have imperfections, there are going to be errors. And we have done the research on this half a century of research is available on this, which shows that when market errors are relatively large and inflation price stability is, inflation is low, then historical cost actually gives you better mean squared error econometrically than mark-to-market accounting. When measurement errors are relatively small, and prices are relatively unstable, you are better off in that other direction or somewhere in between. it's all been done in great deal, but they were not interested in that. They just did fair value accounting as a rhetorical label, okay, and ignoring all the research results. And now that markets became illiquid, the imperfection increased, the errors increased, they gave a lot of discretion to the management to do this to the valuation. You get into the pro-cyclicality. You have greater errors of valuation, which those numbers will get into the decisions of these managers. Those decisions will feedback, there's feedback effect between accounting and markets. But let me say one more thing about this, because it goes a little bit deeper, two other levels. One is the problem of the general feedback effect between accounting system and what transactions and entities, business people decide to have. I could say you should account for it like this. And the accountant cannot say what transactions you can enter into and what kind of entities you can design. Lawyers will decide what kind of entities you'll decide. Goldman Sachs will decide what kind of transactions, or Citibank will decide what kind of leases you can sign. Accountant has no say in the matter. Accountant can only say, if you have this entity, this transaction, this instrument, you'll do this. Okay. But the moment accountant writes a rule, what does the lawyer do? Lawyer changes the entity. What does Goldman Sachs do? Goldman Sachs designs a new instrument. What does Citibank do? Citibank designs a new lease. In fact, a large number of financial derivatives are children of accounting. They're offspring of accounting. They were designed specifically to get around the consequences of accounting standards, written accounting standards. And we have moved away in U.S. for the last 75 years after securities regulation came from social norms or common law approach to accounting to a statutory kind of approach to accounting where we write everything down instead of relying on, you know, fair representation, true and fair representation, kind of general criteria. Now we rely on line and verse of rules, and that makes any accounting rule, fair value included, just a sitting duck for this game playing. And accountants have never come to terms with this game playing situation. I'll say one more thing, if you will please allow me to do so. So, but there's a third level of complexity here. And that comes directly to the issue of subprime market. Subprime itself. See, how does a car maker make money? You make a car that nobody else can make. Renault car is a special model. It looks beautiful, drives well, people like it. Okay? It's better than Volkswagen, it's better than General Motors, it's better than Ford. You sell the car, right? Businessman makes money by creating market imperfections, local monopolies. That's how you make money. All right? Applies just as well to the securities market. How does a Wall Street firm, an investment bank, make money? Investment bank makes money by creating instruments which are sufficiently illiquid. So there's sufficient bid-ask spread that they can make money on. So the internet comes in, and the mortgage, the sort of plain garden variety mortgage margins get narrower and narrower. Okay, it's not very attractive anymore. What do? You design mortgage-based securities. You design mortgage-based MBSs, now you have 2% margin to work with. Okay? So Merrill Lynch designs it, then Lehman Brothers comes in and Goldman Sachs comes in, that margin narrows down over a few years' time. And somebody comes up with the idea, take the junior tranche of MBS and create a CDO. Now again you have margin. Okay? When the CDO market narrows down, create CDO 2. Then you go to CDO 3. Okay? It's a process. Illiquidity is not an exogenous event. If I am the security designer, illiquidity is a source of my livelihood. That's how I make money. Okay? I'm creating illiquidity. For Federal Reserve Bank or US Treasury or regulators to assume as if illiquidity is a problem and you can fix it by regulation, I think is simply misguided, because you have to understand the economics of this business. And economics of business, illiquidity as an objective is at the heart of the business itself. Anyway, enough said.